Okay.
Okay, hold on. Good evening. This is Winston Wu of Happier Abroad again. Today I'm going to do my second podcast, and it'll be with a friend of mine named Mitchell, who lives on the East Coast. And I first heard from Mitchell when he emailed me about Bellingham, Washington, because I wrote an article about how cold and antisocial it was. I wrote that article a long time ago, and I received a lot of fan mail from it, and one of them was his. And then I heard Mitchell on an interview with Steve Hoka, which was really good, and I posted that on my website. And then once I got in touch with Mitchell, I found out that he and I are on very similar wavelengths. I mean, he's a deep person with a deep soul who's sensitive and aware, and we think alike on so many different levels. And so Mitchell and I are kind of what they're called kindred spirits. And so I thought that he and I would have a podcast discussion about America and what's happening and how it's changed and just sharing some observations because we both see things in a very similar way. And so I thought I would do that in the second podcast. By talking to Mitchell, and he lives over on the East Coast, somewhere in Pennsylvania, I think Philadelphia. So, how you doing, Mitchell?
Oh, I'm doing fine. How are you?
Oh, great. So, you're on the East Coast, and you live in Philadelphia, right?
Actually, right outside of it, in the suburbs of it.
Okay. So, you grew up in the 70s, right, or the 80s?
I would say, been like a toddler back in the 60s, and then I grew up in the 70s, and then towards the end of the 70s, went through my teen years through the latter part of the 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, so how was America different back then compared to now?
Well, it would almost seem like there was a whole different energy about it. Like, if you notice, you know, the expressions on people and how they carry themselves, there really does tend to seem like be like a real coldness about people today in general.
Yeah, I noticed that. I mean, in the late 70s, I was in kindergarten, and in my daycare environment, the kids and the teachers seemed very warm and kind and caring. You know, kids are kids. They have playful imaginations, and sometimes we fight. But I remember that everything just seemed a lot more innocent and more simple, and I always thought it was because I went to a good school, but it was also because the culture in the late 70s was like that. It was more simple. I mean, people were just more natural, you know, and you can see that in the TV shows of the 60s and the 70s. Like, I watch a lot of Westerns and family shows from the 70s and before that, and the people just seem very different. There seems to be a wholesomeness about the people there and a naturalness that you don't see today in modern America. And then during the 1980s, it started to change. What happened during the 1980s? I mean, what's your take on that and your experience?
I've heard a lot of different theories. I heard, believe it or not, like during the Reagan and Bush administration, that's when you started to see it change. You know, for one, people were more concerned once we were, you know, entered the 80s, more about monetary issues. Also, at that time, you start to see a lot of, you know, a lot of your manufacturing jobs go overseas. These were jobs that you had, you know, good, strong unions, and, you know, these jobs also, you know, paid well. And a lot of your, you know, good-paying, you know, blue-collar jobs going overseas, and a lot of your jobs becoming, you know, more service-oriented, and, you know, jobs that tend to be more service-oriented are going to also be more competitive. More backstabbing.
Yeah, and so America basically became more materialistic during the 80s with the Reaganomics.
And more materialistic, but also more insecure.
Yeah, and more competitive. And you noticed that when you grew up in Philadelphia, too, or?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I noticed that, too, growing up in California. And I didn't know if that was the general culture or if it was just my hometown but yeah, it seemed like people became more and more cold during the 80s and not as friendly, not as... it's like the energy turned from positive to negative. People became more paranoid, and then they got much worse in the late 80s, and especially the 90s is when it got the really bad. America became super paranoid. I mean, you couldn't even flirt in the 90s. You can't, just say to a girl that works at your company or, oh, I think you're very beautiful, you have a nice dress, or it seemed like people didn't want to get to know you or talk to you, they were in their own space.
I think a lot of that, I think economics plays a part in it. And I think the reason why, they don't like you flirting is because of all these, frivolous, lawsuits. Companies are afraid of that. I mean, companies are afraid of loss.
Yeah, I mean, lawyers play a part into it because, it's because of the lawsuits. People are afraid of being sued in America.
Well, you have to remember, one of your main careers, industries that was booming in the 80s was, every Tom, Dick, Harry, mother, brother, sister wanted to be a lawyer back then.
Yeah, and, but I don't think it's just because of fear of lawsuits. I mean, people's attitudes changed, they weren't as, they just weren't as positive about meeting people. Like, I don't know if you've been overseas a lot. I know you went to England, but I don't know if you went overseas. Like, if you go to, a lot of countries in Europe or South America or Russia, you'll notice that the women have this positive attitude toward men. They like to meet men. They don't have this negative, fearful attitude like everyone out there is a creep, Nowadays, it seems like people just think that everyone they don't know is a creep, So it's a very negative, highly negative energy field,
Well, I think one aspect of it is there's more fear. There's more media hype and fear because if something bleeds, it leads. Watch news, it's, everything is, all fear-oriented. I mean, most of the stories are, a lot of bad, horror stories or some sad story. And, unfortunately, there's a lot of women that I would say at least one out of five has had some kind of bad experience. I mean, we're also, believe it or not, paying the price for what, a lot of real effed up men have done as well.
Yeah, it seems to be a combination of a lot of different factors,
It's a combination of fear. It's a combination of monetary, material things as well. It's not like one thing. It's like this for a variety of different reasons.
But yeah, and I almost get the sense that there's some type of almost like a virus that has spread to everyone, kind of like a, when I say virus, I mean like some type of like a darkness or a spiritual darkness or some type of energy, negative energy that just spread all over people, and it just contaminated and infected people and changed them. Like during the 80s, it seems like there was this virus that just turned people cold, like a not necessarily a biological virus, but like a energy virus or a dark energy virus.
A social virus.
Yeah, or metaphysical. Because you got to understand that reality has multiple layers. Some layers are physical and some layers are non-physical. And so, there are forces that influence us in the non-physical, I think, okay? And so I think that could be part of it too, And I think with me and you, we're not people that conform, We kind of think for ourselves. And so when a social disease takes over everyone, we don't, just go along with it. You know what I mean?
It's kind of like we're immune to the Dawn of the Dead zombie syndrome.
Yeah, it's like we're outsiders. We're not part of the collective, whereas everyone else tries to conform to whatever's going on. Because most people are followers. They're not leaders. They're not thinkers. They follow whatever the group does, whatever everyone else says.
I think it's kind of like something that I've read and wrote. It's kind of like if you're a dog and you're in a cage, and every time you stick your nose out, your nose gets slapped. That's pretty much, what most people are experiencing.
Yeah, to some extent. So back in the 70s, I mean, you could approach a girl and make friends with her and then ask her to the movies or something. It was very easier. It was much easier than now.
Standoffish or guarded. I mean, people are people. However, it was a lot easier and it wasn't as creepy.
Yeah, because I mean, I see a lot of TV shows, and I know TV shows are dramatized, and some make things look bad too. Like in the late 70s, there was a movie called Taxi Driver with Robert De Niro. Taxi Driver. I don't know if you saw that with
That's
Robert
the
De Niro.
concept of it.
Yeah, I mean, it made New York in the late 70s seem kind of cold and mean and high crime and. But there were many other shows that made people seem very warm and open and friendly. And so, I mean, I think it was a mixed bag, but at least there was no political correctness back then,
There was to a point, but not to the extreme it is now.
Yeah, like if a person was racist, they just said what they thought, it was natural, it was free, they could speak their mind,
It was still like inappropriate to like make any kind of racial slurs or, even make slurs that would be considered insensitive on a sexual basis. But it wasn't as politically correct as it is today, where it's almost repressive.
Yeah, when I was in elementary school, I mean, kids in the early 80s, kids would still make fun of my race, for being Asian. I mean, they would make slanted eyes or stretch their eyes and make it look slanted and make fun of me being Chinese and they would have racist jokes. But I guess with kids, it was more okay than with adults. But yeah, kids would make lots of racial jokes in school back in the early 80s. And yeah, it just seemed like it was, I never liked school. It felt like a prison. It felt like you were in some type of camp where you had to obey the rules. And I mean, it wasn't a fun place. And I never really conformed or fit in. It
Trying to
seemed.
conform, it's. Don't know how to put this, but I don't really think we're neurologically wired to conform for some reason.
Yeah, it's like, if you're a free thinker or a deep soul, you're just different. You have a different soul. You're almost like an alien.
And I don't really think like your schools were actually ever meant to create intellectual people or free thinkers. It was never really designed to create a Mozart or an Einstein or, some great thinker. Your schools are specifically designed like a factory to produce a product and have it go out on the conveyor belt.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of evidence that schools are there to dumb people down because, I mean, the elite don't want people to be too smart or educated because then, if the lower class or the middle class becomes too smart and educated, they could become a threat to the upper class and start threatening their business monopolies and prices and stuff. And so, they want to keep. The lower class low and the middle class as a buffer zone, and they don't want the people to rise up and upset the system or change things or change the status quo. So it's in their interest to keep people dumb. It's like they need you to be smart enough to hold a job and to do math and to be responsible and go to work, but they don't want you to be too smart to think for yourself and to question authority. So,
Basically, they want you to be able to follow instruction and, basically have your faculties together so you can, pull the right levers and push the right buttons.
right, it's like it's like your purpose is to be this worker bee, this robot that produces and is productive. And society is basically a sophisticated human cattle farming.
In a sense, it is. It's almost like we're cattle, and we're cattle to some economic commodity that the powers that be, want.
Yeah, and I don't know if you know who Jordan Maxwell is, but Jordan Maxwell is a conspiracy researcher, and one of his clips was featured on the movie Zeitgeist, the internet documentary Zeitgeist. I don't know if you've seen it, but...
I've watched some of them, believe it or not. They were really interesting.
Yeah, but Jordan Maxwell said something interesting. He said that what the government pays for, it gets. So if the government was not getting the results it wants, it would change things. So what he was saying was that, you know, government-run education is meant to dumb people down because the scores of people in American schools are so low. I mean, they're much lower than people in other countries, like in Japan or Germany.
I've heard that.
Yeah, and so it's like the elite want to keep kids dumb, and Jordan Maxwell was saying that it's obviously by design because if that's not what the government wanted, it would change things. But the government doesn't change things, so that it must be getting what it wants.
No. It's more so now than it would have been, let's say, a couple decades ago.
Yeah, and the American school feels like an oppressive environment. I mean, have you noticed kids in America hate school? I mean, they see it as a negative, oppressive environment. Whereas you go to Europe, for example, and kids are more positive about school. It's more of a positive environment. They don't hate it as much. And in poor countries, it's considered an honor to go to school. You know, it's not considered, it's not like, they don't see it as a prison. It's not like Americans do. So, and the school is a very toxic environment. That's why there's so many bullies in school. There's just so many.
That's why people don't learn properly, and that's why we have a lot of the social issues we do in this country.
Yeah. I mean, have you noticed, like, when you go around a city or a suburb, you see so many depressed-looking people, like, they have nothing to live for, like, degenerate, depressed people, and it's really sad. It's like, what can you do for them, you know? Like, have you seen that when you go out to the supermarket or walk around the city streets, you see kind of, like, these depressed people that are very angry, but they have nothing to live for, and they're, like, they're kind of, like, trapped, you know? And unhappy.
A lot of people you see almost have a scowl on their face.
Yeah, exactly, a scowl. It's like they're perpetually angry and unhappy, and, you know, they don't know what to do about it. They just take it out on everyone.
They kind of just look like very angry people a lot.
Yeah, and you see people who look depressed, too, you know, especially in the cities and the suburbs. You know, it's mostly in urban areas. Because the city is like, the American city is kind of like a soulless environment. It's artificial. It makes you artificial. And we humans are not meant to be artificial, you see. We're meant to be natural. So when the society forces people to be artificial, it just creates all kinds of mental imbalance. You know, it creates mental problems, I think.
That's why you actually have, you know, a lot of crime in a society, a lot of violence, a lot of gangs. I mean, all that is a byproduct of the alienation.
Yeah, and, you know, have you noticed there's just something about America that makes you feel insecure? Like, you kind of feel like you have to prove yourself and that you're never good enough. And if you don't work hard to remain confident and pump yourself with confidence and positive thinking, then you're going to slide into some depression or negative state of thinking. Like, you're going to slide down if you don't work hard to just keep positive, you know?
You know, maybe you and I are just don't do well in, you know, trying to filter things out. You know, some people are better, you know, kind of filtering, you know, what's going on in the environment. They're able to filter it out and be more focused. But, you know, if you're someone who is, like, more of a kindred spirit, you know, free thinker, artistic.
Yeah, or sensitive,
And said we're going to have more of a difficult time, filtering out, you know, a lot of these other energies that are around us.
Exactly. So I've come to that conclusion too, that, you know, if you're a sensitive person, this kind of stuff is going to wear you out, you know, like you can't tolerate a depressing environment and put up with it, whereas someone who's not so sensitive can, you know.
It's not even so much they're not so sensitive, but they're also, you know, much better at being focused and, you know, filtering things out because that's part of the reason why we probably, you know, we're, you know, own school because they basically, the whole idea was to make us, you know, to be, you know, more focused when we were in school. You know, that's why we felt like imprisoned.
Yeah, well, school is a prison, not just because of the rules, but because, you know, I mean, we don't like memorizing so much stuff, you know, and the thing is, I just don't like the social energy in school because, you know, everyone just acts really fake and artificial and phony. And it's like, if you don't act artificial and phony, it's hard for you to make friends or to join a clique. And, you know, it's really hard to make friends in high school. It's not as easy as elementary school. In elementary school, the kids made friends a lot easier. It came more naturally. And your friends were closer to you. You know, in high school, all became about cliques, and everyone had this phony vibe, and, you know, I didn't know how to become phonier or act artificial or act cool, you know, and so I didn't know how to fit into a clique. And the cliques are also very exclusive. You can't just walk up to them and join them, you know. So it was kind of a negative social environment in high school, you know.
I was still able to, you know, meet people in high school, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, your high school was in the 70s. It might have changed in the 80s, especially in California, because California is considered the most plastic and phony state in the U.S.
I guess it depends on what part of California.
Yeah, well, generally, like, the San Francisco area or the Los Angeles area. I just didn't, you know how to act, and so, you know... You know, if you don't know how to, you know, act, you know, you're kind of out, you know, it's like, But, you know, I'm sure in the 80s, have you been to California, or?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, because back in the 80s, you know, that's when it started. And, like me, you went to Washington State, too, and what was that like?
Supposedly, it was supposed to be a very liberated vibe. People there tended to be, you know, very reserved and very guarded.
Yeah, I mean, Washington was very beautiful. It had nice trees and fresh air. And it wasn't too hot. It was kind of a cool temperature. And the rain was, you know, was actually nice, kind of. But the people just seemed like very, very guarded, very standoffish. And the Seattle Times even said that the motto in Seattle is, have a nice day somewhere else, you know. So it was like no one wanted to connect with you. Nobody invited you out. I mean, they would smile and say, have a nice day, but they didn't want to invite you to a barbecue or to hang out or something, you know.
I've heard a lot of mixed stories about Seattle. I've heard, like, before the Microsoft boom, it was actually a lot more open.
Yeah, well, maybe, because, you know, Microsoft, you know, is a giant corporation, and in a corporation, people are very businesslike, and so that might bring, like, a different vibe to it.
Now, what I've heard about Seattle is, heard at one time, you know, people were at one time a lot more approachable, more social. It was more laid back, more down to earth, especially smaller towns like Bellingham. But I think when you had, you know, a lot of your big business, Microsoft, and then the bank that went along with it, everything else, and a lot of, you know, money coming into the area, pretty much that's when it changed.
Yeah. Did a lot of the older people in Seattle tell you that, or?
Yes.
Okay, so, but if they felt that way, why didn't they leave? I mean, these people who told you that.
I guess a lot of people have lived there all their lives, and, you know, they had properties there. That's what they were used to. So a lot of people, they're still going to, you know, stay, but a lot of your older people that are there already established their own cliques.
Yeah, and you're not the only one, you know, or we're not the only ones that have noticed this, because if you Google the Seattle Freeze, you'll see that it's a phenomenon that has been recognized. Even in the Seattle newspaper, the Seattle Times ran a story about the Seattle Freeze and how hard it was to make friends in Seattle or to meet people. So, you know, the phenomenon has a name. It's called the Seattle Freeze. It's not just something you and I think or see. But didn't you tell me or someone else tell me that most people in Washington are have a Norwegian background or something?
A lot of them are of Norwegian descent, and I think right now it's going to attract, you know, people that, you know, come from areas that people tend to be colder.
Yeah, because Norwegians and Scandinavians are reputed to be more cold and not as friendly or warm. And so that might be a factor.
Attract more people that come from the east, like, let's say, from Boston, that are also going to tend to be, you know, a lot more reserved.
Yeah, and I wonder if people who like cold weather just tend to be more reserved. Because some people think it's because of the rain, but, you know, people in England, it rains a lot too, just like in Washington, but the people in England are not the same as in Washington. They're much more broad-minded and more down-to-earth.
They're more upfront, but on the other hand, you're still dealing with people that will tend to be, you know, very private people.
Right, right. So when you were in England, I mean, what was that like? I mean, how would you compare that to America in terms of people and the culture?
Well, I spent most of the time with my girlfriend, but so there were, you know, there were people that I was introduced, but it seemed pretty warm, very talkative.
Yeah, did people make eye contact or smile? I mean, did they have that scowl on their face or?
Not as much.
Uh-huh. Were you in London or where were you at?
Up in York, a city called Kingston upon Hull.
Okay, okay. And what was the vibe like? I mean, how were people? I mean, were they warmer or were they smarter or were they more open-minded or?
Say more or less kind of in between.
So they were kind of like better than well, you live near Philadelphia, and Philadelphia is supposed to be one of the most unfriendly cities in America, so everywhere you go people are going to be seem friendlier. I mean, you
believe
could,
it or not, Philadelphia would probably make Seattle look friendly.
Yeah, like you could go to Arizona and Arizona would seem friendly, or even Seattle. I mean, people in Philadelphia, I mean, they just seem mean, like they have the scowl on their face and they're aggressive and they just take pleasure in being assholes or something. Or
even, believe it or not, New York City is friendlier than Philadelphia.
Oh, really?
Yes, even New York City is much friendlier than Philadelphia.
Yeah, I wonder why people don't just leave Philadelphia then.
Well, a lot of people have, but also a lot of people, you know, have their roots in the area and, you know, already have, you know, established, you know, close friends and, you know, established careers. So they figure, you know, there's really no reason to uproot and, you know, just accept the situation for what it is.
Yeah, it's easy to get tied down, like if you have a job or roots or something. But, you know, I guess it's not that hard to move from one part of America to another. You just have to, you know, do a lot of work and moving and stuff.
Well, it's just like people like you and I, if we go get up and leave, go to another state or even go to another country, we're not really leaving much behind where, you know, a lot of people are.
Yeah, yeah. So when you were in England, you dated a woman, right? And what was that like? I mean, how are the women there compared to here?
Well, the only thing I could say is they're less likely going to dump you for, you know, superficial reasons like they would here.
So they're not as, like, shallow or judgmental, you mean?
If they have an issue with something, I might get chewed out for it, but they're not going to go and dump me.
So they're more, like, down to earth and more, like, they care more about the relationship. They're not as cold about ejecting people like Americans are.
No.
I see. And
they're more sentimental, more romantic about it. Over here, they'll dump you for some of the most ridiculous, most outrageous reasons.
Yeah, and sometimes for no reason, too, you know. some American women will drop you just for the heck of it, just because they change their mind and have no reason to.
I also think that's because we became a byproduct of being a very disposable society.
Yeah, so it's like you can work really hard to, you know, get a girl in the U.S., and even if you succeed, it could just disappear in an instant.
It's
at
kind
any time.
Of a big difference between, like, obtaining something but then maintaining it.
Yeah. So did you feel like you could just be yourself around English women, or?
Pretty much. You can be yourself. You don't have to, you know, try to put on any airs. But then again, I don't really do that anyway.
Yeah. I mean, do they contribute to the relationship and...
How can I explain it? They're more, you know, contribute to it. They're more... I mean, they're... It's more solid. It's like once you're in a relationship, you're in it.
Right. And,
I think over here also, I also feel that the media plays a big part in it too, especially your modern media as we know it today, you know, especially with these reality shows and I mean, most of what you see on TV is like, you know, very shallow, very superficial.
Yeah.
So, you know, very shallow or superficial or very violent. And, you know, violence is more promoted. A lot of your British, you know, programs, you know, people are more real. I remember even watching, you know, when I was a kid, like, there was this one, you know, British sci-fi series called Blake 7, right?
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you ever heard of it.
Yeah, I've seen some episodes of it.
Like, if you notice, it's the kind of world where the good guy doesn't always win. There's no guy on a white horse, and things are more complex, and it's more real that way.
Yeah, I watched a lot of Doctor Who before, and so it's a similar show, yeah.
And journalism's a lot different than it is here.
Yeah, the journalists will talk more about, how are they different, though?
Well, I guess in some ways they're going to be more real. You know, over here, everything, you know, we all have to put on a phony air to survive here.
Uh-huh.
You know, unfortunately, you know, if you put on that down-to-earth, warm, kindred spirit right now in modern, you know, America, you know, you're going to be stamped out like a cockroach.
Yeah, it seems like in America, the only people that are down-to-earth are, like, older people, like senior citizens and, you know... Anyone who grew up before the 80s is more down to earth. I mean, like people who grew up in the 70s and 60s and before that, or 50s. Those are the down to earth types in America.
But it was also a different time. Just to give you an example, if you have like people that were children that grew up in the Depression, they're going to be like more frugal as far as spending. When people were growing up, let's say in the 50s, 60s, or even 70s, the United States still had a very viable economy. We had, you know, a lot of manufacturing. We had, you know, a lot of, you know, good jobs that, you know, were less service-oriented and, you know, more blue-collar. And these particular jobs, you didn't really have to put on this, you know, phony air. But when you're dealing in... jobs that tend to be more service-oriented, we all have to put on this, you know, phony air. A lot of the jobs that are service-oriented, it's a lot more politics, it's a lot more stress, and a lot less pay.
Yeah. So why was the older generation more down-to-earth? Isn't it because there wasn't trash culture back then and people were not as phony?
Well, look at what you would watch on TV, like, let's say, back in the 60s and 70s, you know, compared to what you're watching today. I mean, you can see a huge difference.
Well, yeah, I noticed that. I mean, TV shows were wholesome back in the 50s, 60s, and even 70s. And, you know, people were more authentic and more... The stories were more original, and they had a good message. And now it's like 99% of what's on TV is trash. Whereas in the 50s, they would never let trashy content be on TV, you know?
No. But then again, back then, like, we only had a few channels, this, you know, before cable.
Oh, yes, yes, that's true, too.
You have to remember, back then, you had, like, maybe three or four primary channels and maybe three or four, you know, UHF channels. And, you know, one of your primary channels was usually an educational channel.
Yeah, and people were more simple, you know. They didn't, you know, they weren't just living to consume. They weren't, I mean, it wasn't a mass consumer society to the extreme that it is today.
People were more out and about more. I mean, there were more, you know, events you would do that you would have to go out of your home and do.
Yeah, so they would, I mean, kids would play outside and talk to each other and, they didn't have video games and stuff.
No, you actually back then went to an actual arcade.
Oh, yeah, that was in the 80s, though, I think, yeah.
In the 70s, yeah. Like if you went to, like, let's say, the mall.
Uh-huh. There were arcades in the mall.
Let's say you lived in Bellingham, so let's say you went to the Whatcom County Mall. Back then, you would probably have a pinball arcade where you have pinball machines. You would have, you know, one of those machines that you would, from a sub, you would shoot boats with. But you actually had to go out and interact with things. You would, you know, there was a lot of, you know, places you would meet people back then. You could go to the bowling alley. They had skating rings. You know, if you lived in, let's say, an apartment complex, they would have a clubhouse and you would have different social events.
Oh, really? In a clubhouse in the 70s?
Yes, you would have, like, different, you know, like you would have, you know, singles nights when singles would get together and meet up. You had more meetups and,
oh, wow.
You know, things were different. I mean, you know, today a lot of things are done online. Then to top it off, we're just hit with so much multimedia crap. It's unbelievable. And so you figure, you know, today, you know, the average person, you know, we're overworked, we're overtired, we're overstressed. And then to top it off, we're just bombarded with, you know, all this multimedia trash.
Yeah, so back in the 70s, could you start a conversation with a girl a lot easier? Like, meet her and just say, hey, what are you doing? Or hey, how's the music, you know, and just, you know, roll the ball from there?
No, I cannot say that it was a perfect world, no, but let's say if you were, you know, found someone that had similar interest, it was, you know, a lot easier to strike up a conversation. And, you know, back then, as long as, you know, you were, you know, decent, you're intelligent, you went about approaching the person the right way, you were fine.
So, I mean, there were many opportunities. Like, you could just walk up to a girl and say, hey, are you doing anything Friday night? Could we go to the movies? And they would say, sure, pick me up at 7, like that. Was it that simple, or?
I don't know if it was that simple, but, like, let's say if you struck up a conversation and conversation, you know, became more intense, deeper, then it can lead to in other directions.
Right, so I don't know how old you were in the 70s, but, I mean, did you date more back then than later?
I would just say, you know, back then, most of it I was too young, but it was a lot easier to, you know, meet people. It was a lot easier to, you know, go up and strike up a conversation with, you know, women you didn't know, strange women.
Yeah, and it wasn't easy to hold their attention and to keep a conversation going more than it is today.
Oh, yeah. And it was a lot easier to, you know, go out for a nice walk or watch a nice sunrise.
Yeah, or moonlight walk on the beach.
And, you know, just be more romantic and just embrace that.
Yeah, so the girls back then, it didn't seem like they were in a rush to be somewhere, like they were in a rush to get somewhere else, kind of like today.
I think everyone's in a rush, but you also have to remember today, people today have less leisure time than you did back then.
Oh, really? I would have hoped they would have more. I mean, geez. I mean, with automation and, you know, modern conveniences, I mean, geez.
No. A lot of people today are overworked. A lot of people's, or working two jobs back then. You could make it with, you know, one job that paid a lot better.
So
you more or less back then would have had, you know, weekends off.
So was the cost of living lower back then? I mean, was it easier to make a living? Or
The cost of living was lower. Things were less top-heavy.
I mean, back then, could people pay off a house mortgage quicker? Or, I mean, how much was a house and how long did it take to pay it off? And
you figure, like, a house today that might be a couple $100,000 might have been about maybe $35,000 back then.
Wow, that's like a tenth of what it is now.
And I'm not exactly sure because I don't own a house, but so I don't know if I'm, you know, totally
correct. I'm talking about like a house in the suburbs, for example. Of course, in the big city, it's more expensive, but in the suburbs, it would have been cheaper, and you could have paid. I heard you could pay off a house in a few years.
And if you live further out in the rural area, it would have been cheaper as well, because, you know, everything is based on location, location, and location when it comes to real estate.
What about when you went to a restaurant? I mean, was it cheaper? How much was it in the 70s?
You know, food was cheaper. Although in the 70s, we were hit with high inflation.
Yeah.
But, you know, nothing like this.
Like, how much did a hamburger cost or a restaurant meal?
That I'm not exactly sure. I really can't give you a number on it. But just to give you an example, like, for less than $10, you can fill up your entire gas tank, and even if you had, like, a big truck.
Yeah, well, yeah, I would imagine it would be less. Like, you know, at a restaurant, maybe you could get a meal for $3 or something, or $2.
Now, like, let's say, you know, for $10, you can get a nice lobster dinner back then.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Today it might be near 20 or more, 30.
Probably more like 40 or 50.
But I just mean like a standard meal, like at Denny's, for example.
Like, I would say something like that, I would say under $3.
Yeah, because today everything in Denny's costs like $9.95. You know, everything is almost, is $10 at least.
Like I said, back then, for $10, you know, you have a nice, you know, lobster dinner, or, you know, a surf and turf dinner, which, like a lobster tail and a little steak.
Wow.
And Coke.
Yeah, and the music was better back then, too. The 70s music, it seemed to have a bit more soul and stuff.
Music today has no soul.
Yeah, today it's like it's trying to screw up your brain or something, or damage it.
It would almost seem like, I don't know how to put this, but it would almost seem like there would be some something going on. I mean, something or is trying to, you know, socially engineer us to be something. What? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the conspiracy movement has a lot of theories on that. And, you know, when you guess about, you know, what the ruling elite are doing, you know, all you can do is speculate and put together evidence and, you know, connect the dots, you know, but it really depends on who you listen to, you know. I kind of think everyone has a little bit of truth. And so, you know, like somebody like David Icke or Alex Jones, they have some truth, you know, but they exaggerate a lot too. So I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons, and most intelligent researchers have a bit of the truth, you know, but nobody knows everything, you know?
I think what I really think is this, I think a lot of their policies and economic policies and marketing strategies, you know, play a part in it. It might not be actual deliberate, but what's going on now is more of a fringe benefit to them.
Yeah, and also things go in cycles, you know. Like, if you look at history, you know, governments and countries, you know, rise and fall, and they get better, and they go down into debauchery, too. So there's always a cyclical nature of history. And, of course, there's corruption, too, in politics. And once a government starts growing, it doesn't want to shrink because, you know, it needs money to and more power and control in order to expand. So that's why the founding fathers of the United States, you know, always emphasized that government should be small and only protect the liberties of people. It should never become big and start doing too much. It should only protect basic liberties. Because they knew once it grows, you know, it doesn't. It's gonna become a monster, and not stop.
And right now, our governments have become have grown too big.
Yeah, I heard that. Like after World War II, the government grew like 20 times to what it used to be. So that's not good. Because if a government grows, it's gonna need to pass more laws and regulation, and you know, like, control people's lives and tell you what to do more, and they're just gonna, you know, bother people more, and you know, and impose more rules and butt into your life more, you know. And so the U.S., you know, it has actually become one of the least free nations, because I don't know if I told you this, but America has more laws and regulations than any other country in the world. So, you know, with more laws, there's more control, so there's less freedom. So it's actually one of the least free countries. It's not the land of the free anymore. It was only the land of the free maybe in the 1800s and the early 1900s, but not in modern times, no.
No.
Yeah. Hey, Mitchell, we've already done 45 minutes. Do you want to continue or do you have to get back to work, or?
We can continue another 15 minutes. This is becoming more interesting.
Okay, that's good, yeah. I just wanted to let you know.
So, I really think part of it is the fact that, you know, overpopulation, that's playing a part as well. I mean, you know, right now the world's at over, you know, 7 billion people. Back then it might have been maybe 4.
Yeah, that's definitely a factor. I brought that up to somebody. I don't know if it was to you or someone else that, you know, of course, if there's a bigger population, then you need more laws and more controls and more people to watch them and more rules, you know, but...
I'll give you an example. Like here on the East Coast, like Pennsylvania, New Jersey, they're going to have more regulatory laws here than, let's say, I would if I lived in Washington State.
Right, because Washington has less people.
I'm less likely going to get pulled over for some stupid traffic infraction in Washington State than I would here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I noticed that. Like, if you're driving around Arizona or Utah, out in the middle of nowhere, in the desert or in the mountains, I mean, nobody really pulls you over because... You know, it's like nobody bothers you, you know.
I mean, over here, it's like any little thing. You don't even have to really be doing a moving violation, but if you don't have, like, the right sticker on your car, they'll pull you over and fine you. You know, it's a lot more, you know, regulatory things here than you would have, like, let's say, if you were, you know, in the state of Washington, for instance.
Yeah, I've noticed that. Yeah, because the cops have a quota, you know, of tickets that they have to give out, and they have to meet a certain quota, so...
I don't know if it's that. I don't think it's that, from my understanding. But it's kind of like anything else, where if you're not giving out a certain amount of tickets, then you're not doing your job.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I've heard from ex-cops, you know. They've gone on record saying that there is a quota in the tickets they have to give out. And so the worst time to speed is at the end of the month, because the cops that have not made their quota will be looking for excuses to give tickets. So the best time to speed is in the beginning of the month, when the quotas, you know, have been reset. But not the end of the month.
It could be any time, believe it or not. It wouldn't make a difference. It's a situation where a lot of money, you know, is made through, you know, fines and other punitive things. Because if not, then, you know, then the tax dollars would go up.
Yeah, and no, I prefer taking public transportation like they have in Europe. You know, you get more exercise and you can walk and talk to people. In Philadelphia, can you get around without a car? I mean, is the public transportation really good? Or?
It's good, but I wouldn't say it's the safest.
So it's not as extensive as New York, right?
I would say it's about you know, 70%, it's pretty good, but, you know, it's just a pain in the neck to take buses.
Yeah.
Like New York, I can walk most of Manhattan, you know, and not have to be worried about being constrained, being in the vehicle.
Right. So when you take public transportation, I mean, it's like in America, you don't really meet people, right? I mean, people just are kind of cold toward other people. There's a cold wall, you know.
Kind of like if you were to chat up a conversation with someone, let's say on a bus or, you know, subway or commuter train, that would be, you know, considered, you know, inappropriate socially.
Yeah, what I found is that, you know, older men tend to be more talkative towards strangers. I mean, are you able to at least talk to, like, older men there?
But then again, if I'm talking to women, I much prefer talking to women that are more around my own age.
Yeah, but I'm talking about older men. Older men tend to be very, like, talkative towards strangers. They tend to be more willing to talk to a stranger. I mean, in Philadelphia, are you able to, like, chat up, like, older men, or...?
Actually, believe it or not, most people here are going to tend to be very guarded.
Oh, even older men, like even seniors? And
yes.
Okay. Because over, you know, in California or even in the Southwest USA, the older people are pretty friendly and, you know, they talk to strangers pretty easily. The older people, especially in the small towns, like in Arizona or New Mexico. And I think you live...
Like places like New Mexico and Arizona, especially New Mexico, you don't have the population and the density you would have, you know, here in the Philadelphia area. The area, actually it's called the Delaware Valley, which would encompass, you know, Philadelphia, Delaware, New Jersey, South Jersey, all of that.
Yeah, and you used to live in New Mexico, right?
I lived there for a few years. So a place like New Mexico, people are going to tend to be more open, you know, even in a city like Albuquerque, you know, more so than Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, even the women.
Uh-huh. So were you able to meet more women in New Mexico, or...?
They're a lot easier to talk to and a little bit more inviting.
Yeah, I noticed that when I drove through there, that people were more laid back, and the waiters in restaurants would talk to me, even the female waiters, and you know, in California or Washington, or even in Las Vegas, when you go to a restaurant, the waiters don't make conversation with you, they just take your order and go. You know, but I noticed in New Mexico, they would talk to you more and ask you where you're from, and, you know, and, you know, it had more of that vibe, you know, that, you know, like, they would say, oh, where are you from? And then, you know, and ask questions about you and stuff.
Had more of that intellectual curiosity.
Yeah, yeah. Except New Mexico seemed like a very poor state. You know, the towns were in kind of bad condition. And, you know, it seemed like there was a lot of poverty there and bad infrastructure and, like, in the small town, dumpy areas.
And also Albuquerque and some of these towns also have high crime as well. But I think in places that tend to be wealthier and, you know, a lot more industry, people are going to tend to be more guarded.
Yeah, I noticed New Mexico didn't have a lot of tourists, you know. Most of the tourists go to Arizona or Colorado or Utah. But New Mexico is not as visited. Like, there's a lot of German tourists that drive around Arizona and Utah because there's so many canyons, not just the Grand Canyon, but lots of other little canyons like Arches and Canyonlands. And also in Arizona, there's many canyons and Navajo lands. And the Europeans go there a lot, especially from Germany. Germans like going to Southwest Canyons, but they don't go to New Mexico very much because I guess most of New Mexico is not very scenic. except the area in the north around Los Alamos, you know? Have you been to Los Alamos, or?
I've been through it, and also a really cool place is, you know, going through New Mexico to Durango, Colorado, which you're going up through the northwest corner of it. It's a lot more scenic.
Yeah, Colorado is a beautiful state. I noticed that when people live near nature, they tend to be more down to earth and more laid back if they live in a small town that's surrounded by nature, you know? Because nature puts you more in touch with what's natural. It puts you closer to God almost. And I believe it puts you toward closer to your authentic self, not your socially created artificial mask that society creates. And when you're closer to nature, you act more natural. You're more down to earth, too.
A lot of people in more urban environments, it's not even so much that they want to have to be a bunch of, you know, fake, phony assholes. It's almost like you're constrained to be that way because if you don't, it can have some very dire consequences.
Yeah, but you do nature photography, right? I mean, you've gone hiking, right?
I do a lot of it. I'm probably going to do some of that today as well.
Haven't you noticed when you're hiking that the people who like to hike are more, you know, are more likely to smile and wave and say, hi, how are you? And, you know, and they just seem more relaxed and more, you know, friendly.
You know, more so than if you're walking through a Walmart in the suburbs. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's like once they're out in nature, they're more relaxed and are more likely to be more friendly and positive, you know? Whereas in the city, everyone looks angry and in a rush and paranoid.
It's almost like you have to put on that facade when you're in that environment because there's so many things you have to be concerned about. There's so many things that if you are open and wear that on your sleeve, there's so many things that can go wrong as a result because it's almost like if you're too open and, you know, if you wear that, you know, down-to-earth kindred spirit on your sleeve, it's almost like you're opening up a portal to, you know, dark things.
Yeah. Well, if you're down-to-earth, I don't see how you're opening a portal to dark things. I mean,
technically, it shouldn't be that way, but unfortunately, in urban environments, it is because, you know, you have a lot of, you know, very competitive, yet very vindictive people as well.
Yeah, that seems kind of upside down. I've just never understood, like, how people make friends or get into relationships in America. If everyone's so antisocial, how do people make friends or get married or get girlfriends? I mean,
I think people will generally meet people through some kind of controlled environment.
Like what? Can you give some examples?
Like, believe it or not, even though it might be considered inappropriate and fear of, like, the harassment issues, a large percent of people, believe it or not, meet people through work.
Uh-huh.
You know, or, you know, people through different, you know, organizations or events that they're part of.
Yeah, because I don't think the average American has a whole lot of friends. They probably have a few hangout friends or acquaintances. They don't have, like, a lot of close friends or a great social network.
That's because today, a lot of times, people don't really have time for other people as much as we did, let's say, you know, back in the 70s or early 80s.
Yeah, or sometimes they probably spend a lot of time on dating sites, and, of course, they have to lower their standards, too. I mean, it's hard to get anyone attractive in America. I mean, you almost have to lower your standards and not care about looks, you know.
Well, the problem with meeting women in America right now is I was born at the very tail end of the baby boom, but people that were born after it, there was more of a baby bust, which meant that due to the fact that there was less people being born, the ratio between men and women pretty much equaled out, and in some situations there might even be more men than women. But let's say if I would have been born sometime in the 50s or early 50s, I would have, you know, had, you know, a lot more options as far as the availability of women.
Yeah, I mean, the Census Bureau says that there's almost the same equal amount of women and men, but it seems like there's a lot of single men, but not a lot of single women.
A lot of the women were pretty much going to be spoken for, and there's also a lot more men than what's stated on the census. You have, you know, more people, you know, moving in and out from different areas. So there's going to be a much greater competition to connect with women than there would have been, you know, let's say 35, 40 years ago.
Yeah, and it's like you can't just show up at a bar and expect to meet women. I mean, it's not that easy. I mean, you don't just...
No, and believe it or not, cold approaching is seen as something very negative now as a non-spoken word.
Yeah, it's like out in public, people only talk to each other if it's for business. And so you would have to have a really good social network. You know, like especially like, not just at work, but if you were part of a band or I don't know, part of some charity group like or you know, or part of a church, for example, you might have a little bit more opportunities. But, you know, either way, I mean, it's still not going to be easy because most of the women that are single, I mean, they tend to be either really picky or just, you know, kind of low quality, or they have problems. I mean, it's hard to find like a quality single woman in America, you know.
When you're dealing with a lot of your single women, what you're looking at is you're either going to be looking at women that are going to be extremely superficially picky, or you're going to be dealing with women that are going to have a lot of very complex issues.
Yeah, and even when I was in college, I started going to college in 1992. You know, it's like every girl I met told me she had a boyfriend or something. You know, and if not, then she would just say, "I just like you as a friend." And I found Asian girls easier to date because, you know, because I'm Asian, and so they're not going to be as racist toward me. But, you know, I was into white girls back then, and so I could not, you know, date a white girl because they were just so, like, you know, anti-Asian. They didn't like dating Asian guys. But it seemed like most girls were taken, you know, like even in college, you know, and college was not the fun place that it was hyped up to be in the movies. And I don't know if it was because I went to a bad college or that's just how college generally is. I mean, people are still very business oriented. I mean, they go there just to take the class and that's it. They don't go there to meet people, you know.
That's generally how it is in college. It's not like you see in movies, and it could be a lot more difficult, and a lot of the girls going to be in college are also going to tend to be very picky.
Yeah, and you and I are not very tall, so according to most girl standards, we're not their type either, you know.
To give you an example, I've known men back in the 70s that were even shorter than I was, and they were like almost a real rock star with the ladies.
Oh, because they had certain charisma, or why?
It was probably a combination of that, you know, but what it really comes down to is, like, let's say I'm not that tall, but let's say I'm still attractive, still have really good, strong, all-American facial features and all that. However, I think that's contributed to the fact that today we live in very insecure times.
Yeah, it's like if you grow up in America, it's like you're almost definitely guaranteed to be insecure. It's like you're, you know, and it's like everyone's trying to compensate for this insecurity by acting really tough and phony and arrogant. It's like you have to compensate for this insecurity. And I wonder why that is. Why do people seem so insecure in America? I mean, what creates it? I mean, nobody told you to be insecure, right?
Taught that way, but it's almost like we just keep getting beaten down and beaten down and beaten down. How can I explain it? Like, if this was decades ago, when we had a more viable economy, you know, there was more of a sense of stability, but now, you know, nobody knows what tomorrow is going to bring.
Yeah. I mean, back in the 70s, were people that insecure too, or what was it like?
Well, back then, it was like, you know, as long as you worked, as long as you were reasonably educated, as long as you were intelligent, as long as you spoke well, very articulate, good diction, good grammar, you were fine.
But people didn't act as insecure, right?
Not like they do today.
Huh. What about back in the 70s? I mean, did neighbors talk to you? Did they, you know, invite you over to for a barbecue or something? Or?
Back then, they were more likely to do so.
And I remember, like, the kids in my neighborhood in the 80s, they would, you know, they would always come over and play and you know, and, you know, we would play ball outside and stuff. And the friendships just were a lot more natural back then. It doesn't seem like kids play as much outside anymore. I mean, they still do, but they're just, you know, they're just inside more or something.
Just today, you know, there's, like, so much liability. I mean, you're dealing with, you know, insecurities, and you're dealing with, you know, elevated fears right now.
Yeah, and the kids don't even come out on Halloween for trick-or-treat anymore. Have you noticed that?
I haven't really paid attention, but I think a lot of your Halloween activities are going to be more controlled now than it would have been, let's say, 3 or 4 decades ago.
Yeah, I remember going trick-or-treating was fun. I mean, I don't know why no one does anymore. I mean, it was like a highlight of my life. I mean, I don't, like, it's hard to imagine something so simple could be so fun, but it was.
I mean, like I said, today there's a lot more fear than we dealt with, you know, decades ago.
Yeah, it's like today they think, oh, what if a stranger puts something bad in the candy? I mean, who's going to do that? I mean, that's just...
We feared
crazy.
That back then, too. It was like when you brought your candy back, a lot of times, you know, they always recommended that your parents would inspect it, make sure, you know, things weren't, you know, unwrapped properly or something.
Yeah, but you can't, you know, inspect everything. I mean, you know...
I was fear of people putting razor blades in apples and all that.
Well, you know, I heard that was an urban legend, that those stories about there being needles and candy... I heard that wasn't even really true. That was just an urban legend.
But, you know, fear level is, you know, just elevated and elevated and elevated. And I guess now, due to the fact that we do live in a much more insecure society, people are going to tend to be, you know, more vindictive as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of sad because... You know, when everyone's afraid, it's like, it's such a negative energy field. It brings you down, your spirit. You don't feel as alive, you know. You don't feel very alive in America. Yeah, I mean, someday you should go to one of those fun countries like, you know, Russia or Eastern Europe or South America, you know, then you'll understand what I mean more.
Like I said, I think a lot of it is the fact that, you know, we're living in very insecure times, especially here in North, you know, Anglo-America.
Yeah.
You know, times we're living in, it's a lot more insecure and a lot more fear.
Uh-huh.
And there's probably a lot of profit made out of it. I mean, it's a way of, you know, keeping people in line. You know, it's a way of, you know, keeping people from, you know, thinking outside the box or being afraid to.
Yeah, and also there's no passion or romance. I mean, if you're a romantic person, it's like you're out of place in modern America. It's like, you're a sore thumb.
If we take this to a close, let's say if I happen to be a very open, very down-to-earth, romantic, creative, artistic person, it also means that I'm not going to follow the rules they want in a variety of different workplaces.
Yeah, you get that vibe that they're, you know, romance is out of date, you know.
And the reason for that is I think they want us to be more focused towards, you know, being a workaholic and consuming.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like they want to turn you more robotic and less human. It's kind of like that movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Have you seen that? From
yes.
1978? Yeah, yeah. There was a version from the 50s, and then there was a 1978 one with Donald Sutherland, but in it, I mean, all these humans were being replaced by these pods, and then when they were cloned by these pods, they became unfeeling, with no humanity. They had no feelings and or emotions after they were cloned, and it's like it was like a metaphor or foreshadowing of what was to come in America.
Well, let's say, you know, people like ourselves, like, you know, very romantic in our thinking, very open, you know, intellectual curiosity, you know, being, you know, creative, artistic, and, you know, being able to, you know, think in a very creative, artistic, romantic manner. People like ourselves are going to be less, you know, interested in consuming, and let's face it, we're not going to want to be a workaholic. We're going to want to have more time to go on these, you know, free-thinking, romantic ventures. So, basically, people like ourselves will be more of a threat to the power structure and the status quo.
Yeah, it's almost like. You know, like the Orwellian New World Order, 1984, has already happened. And, you know, a friend of mine told me something interesting. He said that if you're a deep thinker, you're not going to like America, because America is totally predicated on phoniness, fakeness, artificiality, hype, illusion, lies, fakery. It's not predicated on truth or authenticity. So people who are deep thinkers usually don't like America. They usually prefer, you know, like Europe or something, where intellectualism is more encouraged, more part of the culture. It's more conducive. And he made a really good point, you know, like, have you noticed that? If you're intellectual or down-to-earth or very authentic, you just don't fit in America. You have no place. You're like a sore thumb.
Pretty much. It's like, if you don't become part of the machinery, you're not going to fit in.
Yeah, it's like soulless or something. Like even if you have a soul, you don't fit in.
We're going to jam up one of its gears. How's that?
Yeah, and that's such a bad feeling. I mean, the only solution is, gosh, I mean, I hope the whole world doesn't change like that, but, you know, the only solution now is to go overseas, you know, to a country that's still more friendly and normal, where women will flirt with you, you know. And, you know, I was talking to Steve and his friend Hector. You know, remember Steve Nies?
Yes.
I was talking to him and his friend Hector, this Hispanic guy, and Hector said that when he was in Brazil, I mean, the women on buses would talk to him. They would give him Doritos. They would even, you know, give him a kiss out of nowhere. I mean, it was so positive compared to the U.S. The women were just so positive toward men. They were so, like so sweet, and, you know, they were just so much more friendly, and their attitude was completely different than in the U.S., you know. So, you know, that seems to be the only solution, because, you know, Mitchell, if you're on a sinking ship like the Titanic, you know, the obvious logical solution would be to get off of it, isn't it?
Get a life raft and get off and hopefully go to safety.
Yeah, or get on a plane and you know, fly away, because that's the only logical solution. Because America, you know, is sinking, not just economically, but morally, spiritually, culturally, you know, and I don't know if it'll ever pick up again. I don't know if it's like the end of the Roman Empire, kind of like when Rome fell, or, you know, if it's in a bad cycle and it'll pick up again. You know, it's hard to say, because no one can predict the future. But I just know that when you go overseas, you have a happier life. You can be yourself. You can flirt with girls. You can even go to a restaurant and people will talk to you by yourself. You go out by yourself, people will talk to you. You know, it's not as, you know, antisocial as what we have.
Believe it or not, this country, as of now, is more class-oriented than, let's say, England was 200 years ago.
Well, yeah, the gap between the rich and the poor in America is the biggest in the world, you know.
Now,
it's the widest.
Is it possible that we can find other ways of making people more aware of this, and start a grassroots organization. I mean, that could be possible too, but it's something that would take time.
Yeah, well, of course it would take time, but the thing is, the only media we have at our disposal is the internet, you know, because, you know, CNN and NBC are not going to talk about this. They're not going to invite us on and talk about it. The only thing we can do is do podcasts like this and, you know, use internet marketing to just get the message out. You know, and we're all only going to reach a small minority of people, but, you know, that's better than nothing.
We have to make it more broad. I mean, there's a lot more to it than just dating problems. I mean,
oh, yeah, yeah. Like,
and
right.
The dating situation here is just one of the many symptoms to the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I don't just talk about dating on my site. You know, now I'm telling people that, you know, that, you know, it's about health and economics too, you know. For example, you know, if you're overweight, you could go to, you know, Europe or Russia or even China and eat wholesome food, you know, that doesn't have all the chemicals and the processed ingredients and the sugars and the GMOs, and you could lose weight naturally. It's like a big weight loss secret. You go to Europe or Asia and you'll see that people are thin. They're not obese. So, you know, that's a big weight loss secret. And you'll never hear that from the American nutrition or dieting industry because there's no profit in telling people to go overseas to lose weight.
That's all about big pharma.
Everything's corrupt. It's all about money. And
what it comes down to is things that bring people misery make money. Things that make people happy is not going to make money and cost them money.
Exactly, you know, or healthy, you know. It's not profitable for you to be healthy.
No, it's not profitable for people to be healthy, happy, and you know, pursuing this, you know, great, you know, free spirited, you know, intellectual, kindred spirited life. It's not going to be profitable for, you know, the powers that be or the status quo.
Yeah, like you know, a friend of mine named Eurobrat. He went to Italy and he said that the food was so healthy there and organic and they used the best ingredients that, I mean, he was eating pizza and pasta every day and even on that he lost weight because the food is so healthy in Italy. It's probably the best, most healthy in the world.
And it would almost seem like they just try to, you know, weigh us down with all this crappy food, you know, just, and then, you know, gain weight and then we don't look good and our self-esteem, you know, further sinks down. And also I really think that as a fringe benefit they want to destroy people like ourselves.
Yeah, and have you noticed when you eat food in America, even in a restaurant, you feel kind of sluggish afterwards? So, you know, so there is a difference. Food makes you tired and sluggish in America. Plus, in America, life feels kind of empty for some reason, and so people tend to overeat, too. That's another factor. It's not just that food is addictive. People overeat in America, too, to try to fill the emptiness.
I think there's a lot of people that probably are not, you know, really deep thinkers like we are.
Yeah. How was the food in England? I mean, was it different? Was it healthier?
It was kind of different. I mean, they sold a lot of fattening foods, but, you know, people were out and about more and walked more, so it's not like here where everyone's, you know, stuck indoors.
Yeah. You know what I heard
people,
was...
You know, love going to pubs there.
Yeah. Is that just in the cities or in the villages and the suburbs too? Or?
You know, a lot of people, you know, rather, you know, go out interact with the world outside instead of, you know, being stuck inside all day.
Did you go to any pubs and meet people? Or?
No. I don't drink.
Well, you could just order an orange juice or something.
No, I like going to places like little restaurants or coffee shops. I love fine dining.
Yeah. You know, what I heard was that in other countries, you know, I don't know about England, but in other countries, houses are smaller, but most houses are not mortgaged. People own their houses, so they're not debt slaves like in America. Whereas in America, most houses are probably mortgaged.
We're debt slaves to everything here. And that's another way, you know, powers that be want to keep us in line, because that way we're going to be afraid of, you know, losing our jobs and then, you know, falling deeper down the hole.
Yeah, and Mitchell, I don't know if I told you this before, but here's an interesting secret. Did you know that you could go to my native country of Taiwan, okay? And you could, even though you're a foreigner, you're not Taiwanese, you could enroll in their healthcare program. And if you needed, like, surgery or an operation, you know, that would cost thousands of dollars in the U.S., okay, you could, you know, get it done there, you know, for almost free if you just enroll in the program. You know, that's a really big secret that, you know, America obviously doesn't want you to know, that, you know, if you need surgery, you can go overseas and get it done for a lot less than in America. And I don't know if you saw the film by Michael Moore called Sicko. It was a documentary about healthcare. But he followed a group of Americans going to Cuba to get medical care. And so in the documentary, he went along to Cuba with these group of Americans. And when they went to Cuba, they spent like almost nothing. And the government national healthcare gave them all the treatments and the surgeries that they needed. So that's a huge beneficial secret that could help a lot of people that, you know, are in that situation that need medical treatment, that don't know that they could get it for a lot cheaper overseas, you know. If people knew about this, I mean, you know, it could help a lot of people, but, you know, you're not supposed to know that, you know. Because there's this mentality that every problem in America must be solved in America. There's no such thing as solving a problem overseas. Americans are not conditioned to think that way, you see.
Or if you go out of America, it's a horrible, scary world that's dangerous.
Yeah, so there's this assumption that you can't solve a problem in America by going overseas, which is not true, because a lot of problems like this, for example, can be solved by going overseas. And it's not given any publicity, and that's sad, because, you know, Americans should know about these things. You know, they have a right to know the truth, you know, so that, you know, the truth can help people sometimes. And this is one of those cases where the truth can be beneficial, you know. So that's something interesting for you to know. I mean, I don't know what your healthcare plan is, but if you needed surgery or an operation, you could come to my native country of Taiwan or some other country, and you could enroll in the healthcare program, and it would cost you less than $100, and it would fully cover your operation.
Just over here, it's almost, like I said, it's almost as if they want people to be miserable, down and out, and empty, because if we're all free thinkers, it would basically, you know, totally break the quote-unquote power brokers.
Yeah. Well, I almost get the sense that, like, there are dark forces in America that feed off of misery. Like, the engineers of society want there to be misery, because there's dark forces that feed off of it, you know, kind of like demons or you know, devils, or the conspiracy movement now calls them archons, because archon is the word used in Christian Gnosticism for these energetic parasite beings that feed off of human misery and fear. You know, and, you know, it almost seems like that's the truth.
They want to create the energy and harvest it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you're into spirituality or metaphysics, but it just seems like, you know, they want there to be suffering and fear and misery because something feeds off of it, you know.
It would almost seem like something like that would exist, whether it does or not. You know, nobody knows, but it definitely seems there are people that feed off of it. I know that.
Yeah, well, I don't see how people could feed off of it. I guess some people are like energy vampires. They're sociopaths. They like to feed off of bad, you know, misery or suffering, which I can't understand. I mean, that's kind of sick. I mean, I can't understand why someone would do that. But,
well, that's just the thing. You know, you and I, you know, don't think along those terms, so we wouldn't understand it.
Yeah,
we
plus,
might pretty much be able to have a model of, you know, how that would work, but we're not really going to totally understand it because we're not, you know, we're not wired that way.
Yeah, well, you know, people have this fallacious assumption that other people are like themselves. Like, you kind of assume other people think the same way that you do, and that's not true. You know, it's one of those human fallacies that everyone shares.
It's like you and I would figure, why aren't people more down to earth? Why people are not kindred spirits, but they're not going to think the way we think.
Yeah, and they're probably thinking, why are we not like them, you know? They're probably wondering the same thing. You know, they're probably wondering, oh, how come, you know, Winston's, you know, happy being self-employed and traveling and not happy working for a corporation, you know? They probably can't understand that. Because most people don't want to be free, you know, they want to be told what to do.
Well, the fact that we are living in very insecure times, people would rather, you know, give up their freedom for a sense of security.
Yeah, I mean, I found out about that most people don't want freedom. They don't know what they would do with freedom because they have no purpose. They need to be told what to do. They need a structure. And maybe most people need that, you know. Not everyone is, you know, designed for freedom.
I mean, someone like you and I, we can go out there, we can do things, we can be free thinkers, we can go out and just totally explore the whole universe and not have an issue, but other people, they're not capable of, you know, thinking along those lines, nor are they even, you know, wired that way.
Yeah, so yeah, I mean, it's, I guess other people just don't think the same way we do, and they're just on a different wavelength, you know, a different channel. And
are just simply neurologically wired differently than we are.
Yeah, or maybe they just have different souls. I don't know. You know, I can't speak for other people.
Well, no, I mean, I like to think in terms of metaphysics, but I also try to be objective as well. But
yeah, don't you ever get curious about how other people see people like us, like what they think when they see my website or my articles, like, you know, like a conformist type of person?
There's some people who feel like, why do you have to travel out of the States to, you know, get a date, blah, blah, blah. A lot of people, you know, can't think beyond that box.
Yeah, it's like those people are like in a different dimension, a different world. And
you know, like I said, you know, people that are narrow-minded, people that are scared, people that are miserable, people that are angry, people that are vindictive. They're more likely going to be more competitive to where they're going to consume, and it's going to keep whatever's left of this economy rolling.
Yeah.
And that way they're more likely going to be, you know, an economic commodity, you know, to the power brokers, where if you happen to be someone, you know, that happens to be, you know, a free thinker, free spirit, artistic, you know, like to go out there, do things for themselves, be more of an individual, basically, and let's say it wasn't everyone, let's say we're able to bring up the population of people like ourselves to, let's say, you know, between 15, just under 20%, let's say 15 to 18% of the U.S. population, that would be a real blow to the power brokers, and that'd be a real blow to their profits.
Yeah, It's kind of crazy. It's like, how can a small group of people control millions of people? I mean, you know, if there is an elite, I mean, you don't see them. They don't talk to you. They don't touch you. They don't interact with you. How is it that they can control everything? I mean, it's like there's something larger at work, you know, either a mind control mechanism, spiritual dark forces. It's just hard to imagine how a small group of people can control everything. I mean,
like I said, most people are followers. Most people are not individuals or leaders. Most people are just followers. And I think the people that are behind the scene, they know how to use the media to work and work in their favor because, I mean, you're probably dealing with a lot of people when you're dealing with media and marketing. You're dealing with anything from psychiatrists to social psychologists that would, you know, good input on how to make things work.
Okay.
I mean, you're putting a lot into it. I mean, if I was to, let's say, produce a movie that would take place, let's say, in New Jersey, but it's like 200 years in the future, right? You would actually want to research how things are now and where things are going to come up with a more accurate picture of what it might be like.
Well,
I mean,
there.
when you're like producing a movie, you're also, putting a lot of research into it. Remember when I went to art school, if I was producing, let's say we had an assignment to, let's say I had an assignment to produce, something from pre-Paralympic, men in Europe, right? Or pre-Paralympic civilization somewhere in Europe. You would want to, research what it was like back then, do as much research as possible, before you create your project. And, when you're producing, movies, you're doing a lot of research on, what you're producing, what you're creating, what you're writing, your scripts.
Well, I have a theory that people that write books and produce movies, I mean, they're not just making up fiction out of nowhere. I think there's a creative force in people that channels a certain message out. So sometimes a movie might pre predict the future, like foreshadow the future, like 1984 or something Orwellian or some science fiction dystopia. And this creative force could be giving us a message, warning us about what could happen. Because a lot of movies do foreshadow the future and contain a lot of secret truths. And I don't know if it's because the movie director is in on some conspiracy or a cult or some, or they're part of some Illuminati or something.
No, not necessarily. The whole idea is so when I went to art school and you had to produce, a piece. The whole idea is you want to you research what you're doing. You try to look at, where society is now, what it was in the past, and where it could be going. Because I always have to remember, the past equals the present, which equals the future.
Yeah, and creative people are able to see the big picture. They're able to, see a meaning behind it. And I'm wondering if there's a creative force that, generates a message through them. Kind of like, when the people who wrote the Bible, said that, they were being inspired by some Holy Spirit to write these words. Kind of like that. Like there's a higher force. Like it could be from angels, from entities, or spirits, or from God, or just a higher spirit, higher.
People just have that epiphany.
Because a lot of artists and even actors say that when they're doing their best work, they feel like something is channeling through them, like almost like they're possessed by some energy that's doing the work through them,
Kind of like when you're an artist, I mean, we use a whole different section of our brain, and you're also probably neurologically wired a lot different than the average person.
Yeah, but
Sounds
I mean they get it from some higher creative force that wants to promote some type of truth, like
we're even a creative source within ourselves.
Like if you watch the series The Twilight Zone, there's several series of The Twilight Zone. There was the one in the early 60s and then there was one in the mid 80s. And then there's a recent one too. But all the series of the Twilight Zones, I mean the episodes contain so many deep truths about humanity, and also they tell about the future. They foreshadow too, so it's not just randomly made up fiction. It's like they know something.
I have to be heading now, but before I go, there was one episode in the old Twilight Zone. It was about how to do it like this, old librarian, and he was, considered obsolete. I don't know if you remember that one. He was like living, it was like some kind of futuristic, totalitarian type
Yeah, I
society.
think I remember that. Yeah, there were several like that.
then there, then the other one, Eye of the Beholder. You know, a lot of your old Twilight Zones were well thought of, very creative.
Yeah, and they predicted things that, you know, have come true too. You know, it's like the writer, or you know, Rod Serling or whatever, you know, knew things. I mean, he might have been channeling like a creative force that knew things that were going to come. That's my theory, anyways. I mean,
but at any rate, I have to be, you know, heading. But I just want to tell you, it was great doing this interview with you.
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, you're a very deep person like me, and so you could understand. And it's great to talk to someone who's a kindred spirit. Yeah, we should do more of these, and maybe next time, if you want, you could be the interviewer and ask me questions, or, you know, if you want to do that or whatever.
What I really feel is, if we were to change, before I go, if we were to try to change things in the United States, we have to maybe start a grassroots organization. But it would probably have to be communicated right to where it would attract, you know, a greater number of people in.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't believe that, you know, even a group of people can change society, because there's too much powerful forces at work, you know. Even if you were to change society, another force would change it back. I think the most easiest thing is to just go to a culture where you fit in and have more fun, you know. Because it's a lot easier to get a plane ticket and just go abroad than it is to try to change society, you know. So
I'm so angry that I want to fight against it in every way I can. I mean, that's just from my perspective. I just want to fight it. I want to give whatever it is a good sucker punch.
Plus, you know, when you get older, I mean, time is more precious. You don't want to waste time fighting a futile battle. So I would advocate, you know, starting a group like mine on Happier Abroad, where we encourage people to be aware of what's going on and to just go overseas, you know, to be happier. You know, that would be my best solution, you know. Then, you know, because, you know, if you're always fighting against something, that's just negative. It's antagonistic. It's not going to create happiness to always be fighting, you know. Why not go somewhere where you fit in, you can be yourself, you can make friends, you can get dates. Yeah, you can be in an authentic culture.
That too, yeah. But I also like to see a lot of other people free of this, even here. I like to, you know, see this become a better world, you know, for the future and for generations, because something also has to be done here as well. Because whatever it is, you know, I want to, you know, knock it off its feet.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't know. I just feel kind of powerless, you know, trying to
I do fight. Too, but
you can't fight, you know, the government, the corporations, and all the secret groups, and the mafia, and
it might be like a whole network of things, but it really comes down to profit, and it comes down to the people that, you know, have the money. It has to do with your power elite. And a lot of them are probably not even going to be household names.
Yeah, and plus, you got to understand that even if you became a big name and famous and had a large following, I mean, if you get too big, I mean, they have ways of, you know, taking people out who become a thorn in the back. You know, like Martin Luther King or you know, I mean, they have ways to get rid of people too, you know, if they become too much of a threat.
So, which means anything could happen at any time.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you're a small minority of a fringe group that has dissenting views, they don't care about you, because there's too many groups like that, you know. But if you're a person that can move the masses, millions of people, you know, then you become a threat too. So it's kind of like you're becoming a danger too if you grow too big.
So either two things are going to happen. Either I become assassinated, or, you know, murder and make it look like it was some punk, or I end up in some kind of a scandal that completely wipes me out.
Yeah, I mean, they have a lot of ways to, you know, to get rid of someone. They could buy them off. They could make them commit suicide, and they could threaten them. They could blackmail them. You know, it's just, if you think about it logically, it's just better to get off the sinking ship and to just go to a more friendly culture, you know.
Not what I'd like to do, but on the other hand, there's part of myself that I mean, whatever it is hurt me and hurt a lot of people, so I want to hurt it back.
Yeah, well,
you can understand my feelings about it. And that's just my, you know, own blind emotions.
Yeah. Well, I just hope you can see the bigger picture and realize that, you know, it's not healthy to be constantly fighting a war. You know, it's like it drains a lot. You know, it drains you out.
It's not healthy, but there might be some way of defeating this.
Yeah. But while you do so, you should, you know, be having fun and go to a more friendlier culture, you know.
Absolutely. Have fun and just explore, you know, everything from a very creative, romantic viewpoint, because that's what we need. We need a healthier culture, but we also need it here too.
Yeah, so I hope you can save up money and maybe travel with me to Europe someday or to China.
Oh, I'd love to.
Or whatever.
You know what I'd love to do is travel to Europe with you and visit the Ukraine and actually see where my grandparents came from.
Oh, yeah, that would be great.
I would find that very spiritual.
There's so many beautiful single girls in the Ukraine. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, when you go there, you'll wonder, why didn't I come here sooner, you know?
But also, on the other hand, I like to actually do some fishing in the Dnister River.
Well, yeah, that too, you know.
That, because my grandfather did when he was a kid, so I'm going to do that.
Yeah, the thing is, I mean, the bottom line is, when you're overseas, like in Ukraine, the culture is a lot more down-to-earth and authentic, so you feel like you can be yourself, and that's the most liberating feeling, because the true meaning of freedom is being able to be yourself, okay? That's the most important aspect of freedom, you know, being able to be yourself while having fun and feeling accepted and part of the flow. Because
you might not be, you know, surrounded by
yeah, let me
police or KGB or any of that. However, you know what? Basically, psychologically, we're in our own type of concentration camp on an emotional and psychological basis.
Yeah, and you know, the important thing is, you know, you if you were in Russia or Ukraine, there you'll see there's no fakeness in that culture, you know, not in the mainstream. You don't have to be fake to try to talk to people. You know, the social culture is not fake at all. So you could vibe on the wavelength a lot easier.
I have a hard time trying to be fake anyway.
Yeah, I don't know how to be. I just can't. Even though I was into acting, I just don't know. You know, well, acting is not acting fake. You know, acting is like being able to portray a wide range of emotions.
I have another call coming in, so I have to put this to a close, but I will try to get back to you sometime tomorrow night.
Okay, great. Thanks for
listen, it was great
having
doing
me
it with you.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll talk to you later.
Bye,
have a good one.